You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestall. On this episode, I welcome best-selling author, award-winning podcast host, and lover of all things strange, Mike Brown. On his Dark Poutine podcast, Mike casts his net over true crime, cryptids, the supernatural, and much more. We discuss some of the cases he's covered in the past on Dark Poutine, as well as looking at the Granger Taylor case, Falcon Lake, and the mysterious Guardian UFO incidents. Please note, the early portion of this conversation does mention personal trauma in the first 20 minutes. But before we join Mike, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. A big thank you to each and every one of you that contribute and support the show. It is greatly appreciated. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. Our exclusive merchandise store is available via TeePublic, and you'll find the link for that in the show notes too. Our intro and outro music is performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his wonderful artwork, and the show is produced by Mr. Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. So let's join Mike as we shine a light into the shadows of Dark Poutine. We head out on the search for some of Canada's strangest, spookiest and scariest stories today in the company of the one and only Mike Brown, creator and host of the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast, talented author and also a man that managed to survive several episodes of Canada's version of the Traitors before they murdered him.
Mike, they murdered me.
Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. How are we, my friend?
I'm good. There's an... obviously not murdered. There is nothing more fitting than for a true crime podcast host to be murdered on television. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, prime time. Not? Yeah, prime time TV. Oh, those poor people having to watch my face every week.
Well, it makes a change. I have noticed one thing recently, Mike, as a lover of horror films.
Mm-hmm.
I have noticed that there seems to be some film directors who seem to be very angry about true crime podcasters. And I'm thinking of both the rebooted Halloween that came out about 6 or 7 years ago with those awful, awful podcasters that you were cheering Michael Myers on when he catches hold of them in the toilet block.
There is a faction of the darker true crime podcast folk who I wouldn't mind seeing getting taken out either. I mean, I hope I'm not one of those people because I try to, the focus of my show, Dark Poutine, is more victim focused. I was a victim of crime myself at 11 years old, between 11 and 12. And that's what led me to try and understand what it is that drives somebody to do these kind of things and the effect that it has on the community, the families, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, we're not just and then he did this, and then he did that. I'm not interested in that. Hmm. I'm more interested in what the heck happened? Why? Hmm. Like, how? And who was this person? There's a human being at the end of the day who is the victim or survivor, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like it's become the new cliche in horror film offing, though. Because when I finally watched the Terrifier trilogy earlier this year, obviously the third episode features another true crime addict who meets a sticky end, thanks to Art the Clown. And his,
I love Art the Clown. He's
well,
so
I do,
great.
I do. Yeah. But I've seen things in those films, Mike. I was not expecting to. I have to say, even as someone as experienced in the genre of horror films as I am, blimey, there was a couple of times when I went, "Pardon," or went. Very sharp intakes of breath. So,
yeah,
but I do like them.
I mean, yeah, the Terrifier films are definitely groundbreaking in that way. They're taking some chances that haven't been taken since the video nasties of the 80s, really.
You know? Yeah.
And I'm, you know, being from the UK, I'm sure you're well versed in the video nasties.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. Some of my favourite films were video nasties at the time.
There you go.
But yes, I have to say, I thought the second Terrify film is an absolute work of art. Mm-hmm. I'm not too fussed about the first one. And the third one, I think, goes a bit too far. But I think the second one, after about 20 minutes, I thought, this is probably one of the best horror films I've seen in the last 10 years.
Yeah, it's a great film. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, like you say there, in regards to what you try and achieve on Dark Poutine, Mike, this has always been the thing. And I think for a lot of people who have been interested in true crime for a long period of time, mm-hmm. one of the biggest shifts I've noticed over the last decade is the change from the perpetrator to the victims. It was always about who did what, how many, how they did it, what were their little calling cards, what were their signs, all those kinds of things. And very little voice was given to the people who were left in these people's wake.
Agreed.
And I mean, we've had some shockers in the United Kingdom, having grown up smack bang in the middle of one of the most notorious British serial killers, the Yorkshire Ripper.
Yorkshire, yeah.
One of the first occasions I can remember as a child being afraid of where my mother was, I have to say, Mike, and it's a strange memory.
Yeah.
When you're eight and you're thinking, you see the news, you're of an age where you can understand things. I was well read, had a reading age above my age. And so I was fully aware of what they were talking about. When I wasn't one of those 8-year-olds who didn't really grasp the news. I understood it all and didn't really like what I was hearing.
Of course.
And so my mum had to work three jobs when I was a young chap. And one of them was, she was a barmaid in a local pub. And so often she wouldn't get home till 11, half 11. I remember one occasion, and I'd seen a particularly nasty news item about the Ripper's latest victim, I think it was. And I woke up at about 11 o'clock at night, and I went downstairs and I just sat there for an hour, and I was absolutely terrified. He never came through my particular location. He kind of circled round us from Leeds to Sheffield to Bradford and Manchester, and didn't come where I grew up in a town called Barnsley, Mike. But it's one of the memories that's always stuck with me throughout my life, is whilst not necessarily being connected to it, we were living our lives adjacent to all this chaos that was going on all around the county.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 8-year-olds shouldn't have to think about those kind of things, you know. Mm. And that's exactly, your story is exactly the kind of story I would want to tell on Dark Poutine. Like, not necessarily even somebody who was involved, but a member of the community. You were a little kid and it affected you at the time. I mean, my own story, I was walking home from playing floor hockey. I'm Canadian, so it's what we do. And, you know, at night, and I was 11 years old. It was a week from my birthday. Charles and Diana had just gotten married that day, that morning, and I was up early to watch because, you know, the time change. But I'm walking home, and I'm very close to home, around 200 meters, and I had noticed that a man was following me from probably a half a kilometer, for about a half a kilometer, following me, and just behind me just a little, and he kept getting closer and closer, and I thought, maybe I'll just, you know, let this guy get ahead of me. I wasn't completely stupid. So I bent down to tie my shoe, and I could feel this guy staring at me as he went by. Like, I just felt something really wrong.
Yeah.
So he walked ahead of me, ends up turning down a road that's a dead end street. And I knew everybody on the street because it's my neighborhood, and he's not one of them.
Mm.
And as I'm coming to the corner, he turns back and he says, "What time is it? Do you know the time?" And I said, "I guess it's around 10 p.m. And he said, "It's awful late for someone your age to be out." I was a small kid.
Mm.
And at that point, he grabbed me and said, "Don't scream or I'll break your arm." And, you know, started dragging me toward a wooded area close by. And I'm saying, "What are you going to do?" And he told me in no uncertain terms what he wanted to do to me.
Yeah.
And that's not something an 11-year-old child should hear. Like,
no.
Sexualized language. I know it's not sexual. It's about power and it's about, you know, getting
control.
His rocks off. Yes, exactly. But that's not something that an 11-year-old child should hear for the very first time. Like,
no.
You know, that was the first time I heard any sexual language coming in my direction.
Mm.
And it was, it just it destroyed me. And for years, I struggled. I struggled mightily with that. That's, you know, part of what ended up, I drank at that, I drugged at that, all that kind of stuff. I sobered up when I was 23, and I've been sober ever since.
Yeah.
But, that was the kind of effect that it had on me. So when I heard the true crime podcast Serial, it's you know, kind of the one that a lot of people point to, I thought, that sounds like something that I would like to get involved in and maybe do. Because I always had an affinity for audio, and I wanted to be on the radio when I was a little kid. So, I just started thinking about, you know, my own podcast, and 5 years later I had one.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's strange when you mentioned Serial, Mike, because I think people forget how long ago that actually was now. It's what, 2012, 2013?
Something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
And it just completely changed the landscape of that particular genre, really, because shows like mine, when I first started listening to podcasts, I don't know, 2009, 2010, obviously Jim Harold was well established by that point.
Yeah.
But there was a few other shows around and about, and I kind of fell into following them and hearing people who would be on a show, and then you'd search for them and hear them, and it would lead you. And so the supernatural and the cryptid and the Fortean has kind of always bubbled along. Mm-hmm. But true crime just seemed to just explode massively.
It really did, yeah.
But I think that was always going to happen, because you only have to look at the popularity of true crime television prior to that, which is still
Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah, they've always been with us. America's Most Wanted.
Yep.
We had Crime Watch here. I would presume in Canada you had a very similar version to either of those shows.
Yeah, we had some interesting ones. There was one called To Serve and Protect, and essentially it was all the RCMP from around the Lower Mainland of British Columbia, where I'm from, and it was like on the first week that I was here, I ended up as like a spectator on that show, like kind of standing in the crowd going, duh, watching some biker get arrested. Oh, boy.
Do you think, though, it's kind of completely changed now? Because I think when it first started, there was a lot of people going, you know, almost glorifying some of these scumbags.
Absolutely,
over the years.
Yeah.
I mean, even as I say, I'm trying to pick my language very carefully, because I fell into that trap 20 years ago where you'd have these kind of conversations and you'd say, who's your favorite serial killer? And you think now, when I look back, I'm thinking, yeah, that was never the right word. But it's, I don't necessarily think it was a lack of respect towards the people that had been hurt. I think it was just a lack of nuance, I think, or a bit more sort of social intelligence in regards to the situations that people talked about. Because I've always been fascinated, probably very similar to yourself, Mike, that the reason I find serial killers so interesting is that I cannot comprehend how their mind works at all.
How do you get from human being to somebody taking another human being's life? How do you get to that point?
Absolutely. And especially that you then build on it and build on it, and it develops and it changes, and they have little nuances and calling
cards.
It's
their hobby or addiction, yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, I buy Funko Pops and people think I'm weird, Mike. So
I got a few of those.
Yeah. So good. We're in good company. And so it's fascinating for me. And I think also with the development of forensic technology, I think it's kind of given people a real drive to see. I mean, as we're having this conversation, as often happens in these kind of situations, one of the most well-known unsolved murders in America has finally been resolved in the last week.
Yeah, the yogurt shop murders, yeah. Yeah, it was just solved, and solved through DNA.
Yeah, absolutely. And when they said, oh, well, it's a serial killer, I was thinking, oh, right, Texas, around that area, I wonder which one it could be. And then when I saw his name, I was like, hang on a minute, I don't know who this is.
Exactly.
I've never heard of the guy.
Yeah. Well, you do now. You see his name everywhere. And I'm sure we're going to hear 100 podcasts about him as well.
Yeah.
So
it's remarkable, really. But I mean, this is the thing, I think it's really fascinating on so many levels, because as you say, we've got these people like BTK who are quite odd in the realm of a serial killer, where they, for whatever reason, were able to switch it off for decades at a time. which is high. Well, as far like as MacArthur. We're aware. Well, yes, I was going to get to our friend Bruce because it's one of those things. As when it comes to certain Fortean subjects, there seems to be certain cliches or like a template that serial killers are expected to adhere to, regardless that they can't stop unless they're either in prison or they die.
Right.
They stand out, and there are certain things that the more cases you come across, the less rigid that template seems to be for one. And BTK is a prime example. But Bruce MacArthur, who is one of the most notorious criminals in the last 20 years, I would imagine, in Canada, yeah. is an exact prime example of this, because I remember watching the documentary, I think it was Catching Killers, a couple of years ago, because I'd never heard of this case. And so I saw it. I think it was a follow-on episode, ironically, from BTK, might be.
Right.
And I started watching this and I just thought, what is happening here? Because it's one of those things that when certain people start disappearing who are marginalized in some regard, be they sex workers, people of ethnic origin, people who locate in the gay villages in places all around the world.
Some marginalized community, yeah.
It seems to take a fair while for people to suddenly sit up and notice and go, hang on a minute, what exactly is going on here? Whereas sometimes when you see cases like Bundy or BTK, because it's normal people in the eyes of certain individuals, they seem to be straight away elevated to a different level. And it's these other ones that, do you think that's probably sometimes the reason why those certain marginalized communities are targeted?
Absolutely, 100%. These guys, I'm sure they're not rocket scientists, but they have a low cunning. A friend of mine likes to call it low cunning. Mm. And they can see a victim, like any predator. They're predators. They can see a victim that nobody will miss. Or if anybody misses them, it'll be very few people. Or maybe even the people who miss them will think, well, maybe something else happened to them because of the lives they led. You see police reactions. A lot of times I've done so many episodes where police have refused to look for somebody because, they ran away once. And if they have a history of running away, then maybe that's why they're... And I'm certain that these serial killers look for people who are going to be easier targets than, you know, look at the attention that someone like Gabby Petito got.
Yeah.
And when she was killed by her boyfriend, Brian Laundrie, like she was missing for a while. Nobody knew where she was, but she was this high profile person, a blonde haired, blue eyed, pretty girl, young, her whole life ahead of her and lots of potential in the eyes of many people. Maybe she could have done something with her life and this guy took her life and people were fascinated by that. But you swap Gabby Petito out with somebody who is of color or maybe another marginalized community, you don't get the same attention. You just don't. And all of those people have the same potential that Gabby Petito had. They just weren't pretty, in the eyes of the whatever social media algorithm or whatever, whoever ridiculous person makes that decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we see it all the time. So many cases I've covered are like that. Mm. Just why you see all this attention given to one, but none to another that deserves just as much.
Absolutely. I mean, it is infuriating, I think. I think when I look at certain cases, we had a serial killer here who was targeting gay men, two of whom were found dead outside his house, Mike. And the police just kind of said, well, you know, these things happen. It is what it is. It's their lifestyle because he drugged them. And it was only when it got to the fourth victim.
Right.
Who and his family were absolutely adamant. There's no way our son would have done this. Doesn't take drugs. He's completely, he doesn't really drink a lot. And he's got this level of intoxicants in him that is just absolutely off the scale. This is completely out of character. And it was only then.
Is this Stephen Port you're talking
about? Yes.
Yeah, I remember that case, the grinder killer.
Yeah, and you were like, hang on, there's two dead... If you found a dead body out of anybody's house, you'd be suspicious. For it to happen twice, Mike, and people go, oh, well, that's surprising, is just, in this day and age, is baffling to me.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But it's like we've talked about, those two people were people that wouldn't... No one would expect them to be victims of a serial killer, number one. And, you know, like, I don't know. It's a hard one. That's a hard one.
It is. I suppose as well, as we touched on it, I mean, Bruce is a prime example of one of those people who's acting out in plain sight, because what he did and how he lived seemed to be very, very different. Because one of the things that struck me, obviously, there are many strange aspects to his case, was the fact that the people who he worked for all said he was lovely, he was kind, he was considerate, he was punctual. Yep. He was the perfect person to have tend your lawn, sort your plant pots out. People really, really liked him. And yet, we've got this incredible darkness going on. And when I watched the documentary about him, it was quite eye-opening in several aspects, primarily that Canadian police don't need a search warrant if they want to get into your house. They just break in and download.
It depends on what's going on.
Yeah.
Like they broke into Bruce MacArthur's house because they knew that there was potentially a victim inside and they had legal recourse to do so. Mm. So, but yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a strange case for that in particular. But yeah, had they not known another man who was actually looked like MacArthur was going to end his life that day, had they not known that, they wouldn't have been able to do that, just like any other jurisdiction.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's, I mean, and once again, he's one of them. He was questioned twice. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No issues. Police said, yeah, off you go. But I mean, that's another aspect. Is this one of those things from all the cases you've covered and from Canada and beyond, Mike? Is this, because it seems to happen quite a lot where, I mean, the Yorkshire Ripper, the prime example, I think he was questioned 9 times by
him
the police.
And his weird underwear, yeah.
You know, especially about the £5 note. That was, you know, they got it down to 111 people and he was one of them again. And they went, I mean, how
many times?
Yeah, but it's one of the, ironically, that case is the reason we ended up having a centralized criminal database here, because there were so many strands and tips that they just couldn't collate them, and he was jumping jurisdictions. And so they were really confused as to what was going on and not realizing that he was doing it in West Yorkshire and then going to Manchester as well.
We had similar things with Clifford Olson here. He was eventually convicted of murdering 11 children. But he was jumping jurisdictions, and it was before the days of the connected computer, and, you know, the cops didn't know to talk to each other about it at the time. So he is the reason why we have our interconnected system here. So it had to take horrible tragedy to drive forward our forensic technology, but, you know, it was the need. I mean, if there's going to be one Clifford Olson, there was probably going to be more.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. Was it one of those cases where, this is the thing that sometimes strikes me about this, and I've seen this in a couple of cases from the States as well, that you would have departments who would seem to be very precious about their information or their particular cases, and they wouldn't talk to each other. Zodiac is a prime example, as is the Golden State Killer.
Definitely.
You'd got cases going on in certain jurisdictions and nobody was talking to each other. I mean, the Zodiac film does a rather amusing take on this, that they're having to ring round everybody and they're saying, oh, no, I haven't got that bit. You need to ring that department because that's over the border. And so you can only imagine how confusing that was going to be and how many of these people slipped through the cracks, Mike, because of administration and bravado.
Yeah, I've talked to some of the victims, the East Area Rapist victims at CrimeCon. It was 2 weeks after he was caught.
Mm.
And, you know, they were all planning on going to CrimeCon anyway to talk about these crimes that had yet to be solved.
Yeah.
And so they're all showing up at CrimeCon 2 weeks later, and now it's solved. And what do we talk about? How do we react to this? So I had access to these people, these mostly women,
yeah,
who were, you know, just over the moon that this guy had been caught finally. And what an interesting sisterhood they had together. Yes. You know, they traveled together like this little pod, you know, and just such wonderful, kind people. And you think, what a burden to have to carry for most of your life to have had that happen and then not know who did it for so long.
Yeah.
For so long, these women didn't know.
Yeah. It is. I think it's quite inspiring how they've come together in that manner, personally. I think it's helping them share their burdens, and they're not alone, because often people who are the victims of such crimes feel completely withdrawn often, or
I
feel...
I know I did.
Yeah. Mm. You feel completely lost. You can't talk about it. You feel like you're bottled up completely. And the people I know in my life that have gone through similar things, yeah, it's very difficult to have that kind of freedom of expression when you've had something so traumatic happen to you. And I think whenever I've seen them speak together or be together, I find it incredibly heartwarming and positive. And it's a strange end result after something that was so heinous to so many. And yet I think the fact that they've found each other has helped them all not necessarily come to terms with what happened to them, but certainly lessen the burden on each individual in that particular case, Mike.
In a weird way, it kind of gives me hope for humanity. You know, I see a lot. I saw a lot of that when I was at CrimeCon. You know, JonBenet Ramsey's dad doing his thing, and Kathy Kleiner, who is one of Bundy's victims from the Chi Omega sorority house. I got to have a good conversation with her, and you know, just being able to share their stories, being able to feel like they've got a community of people behind them. Mm. That's what true crime really should be,
yeah.
I think, is a bunch of people who are like, that really is awful that happened to you, but let's do our best to lift you up and take care of you.
And I think the perfect metaphor for him, I can't, this is the thing now, I've gone full circle these days. It's very rare I'll mention the perpetrator's name, because I think it's irrelevant these days, Mike. Not sure if you share that opinion these days. Was the wonderful footage of him being wheeled into court in his wheelchair, and oh, he's so frail. Then the defense played the video and went, could you explain this, sir? And he's there doing push-ups and pull-ups, and he's all over.
Jumping up and down off the counter and all this kind of stuff. Oh, yes, you are very frail, and you could never have done that and wouldn't do it again.
No, absolutely. You're too infirm to be a danger to anybody.
Poor little old man.
Really, really made me chuckle, I have to say. In a very dark case, that was a moment of levity, I think, because the look on his face, it was priceless. Priceless. Yeah.
I do say the names of the killer in my show. There have been a few where I have not, for various reasons. And there are certain cases that I probably will never cover.
Yeah.
One is the case, and I've sort of waffled on it a little bit, but the case of Luca Magnotta. I don't know if I can ever cover that, because that guy loves to hear his own names so much. I don't want to be somebody else who's pumping his tires in any way, you know? And there's not enough about his victim to really have a good conversation about without getting really into the weeds with the weirdo who was Luca Magnotta.
Yeah. I mean, some of them are just, I mean, Israel Keyes is another one.
Oh, yeah. With his weird little giggle and his, the guy skeeves me out.
Oh, yeah, he really sends the... Not many people of that ilk give me the heebie-jeebies.
Yeah.
But he does.
He puts heebie on top of the jeebie, yeah.
Absolutely. But it is just fascinating on so many levels. And like I say, there are so many weird cases that you look at. And I think often One of the things that strikes you when you look at these kind of individuals is this need for adulation or fame, even perhaps, for some of them. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes some of them just do the stupidest things.
You know,
BTK with the, if he had not done what he did, he'd have probably passed away and nobody would have ever known who he was.
The profilers knew that it was getting to his ego that they were blaming somebody else, and they essentially drew him out with that. Will a floppy disk be able to be traced back to
tell the truth?
Oh no, yeah, just tell the truth. Okay, yeah, no. No, the you're floppy. And it goes back to his church, and it was a person named Dennis who was logged in at the time.
Yeah, and they went on the website, who's the only person called Dennis who works there? Oh, it's the head of the church.
It's the head of the church who's a bit of a dick. If I can say that. I'm not
of course
sure
you can. People have said worse, okay. Mike. You're all right.
Okay, fair enough.
And it is ego a lot of the time, isn't it? Which is why a lot of them claim things they've never done or never been in. I'm trying to think of the guy who claimed basically...
Henry Lee Lucas.
Yeah, he'd just say yes to anything. And they were just going, oh, what about this case we've not solved from 20 years? Yeah, mm-hmm. I did that.
I killed JFK, too. Just so you know.
I'm surprised he didn't claim starting World War II, to be honest.
Right.
He wasn't far off. Yes, I invaded Poland. It was me.
His story is very strange. I mean, his dad lost his legs. They were run over by a train when he was a little kid, and Lucas lost an eye. And there's like various reasons that he's given for that over the years. What a weirdo. Mm. But, you know, claiming that you killed so many people, what drives that? And it obviously is ego, but how does your ego get so twisted up that that's what you want to hang your hat on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I suppose as well, sometimes you'll see some of these characters and they almost seem quite shy about what they've done. They want to talk about it, but they're not giving it the big bravado or seeming to revel in it. I mean, Gary Ridgway is probably a best example of that. I mean, he horrendous. And I would imagine there's probably more than they've tied to him down there, because he seemed completely out of control, especially towards the end.
I watched his allocution.
Yes.
And what was interesting in his allocution, when he was being sentenced, he had to say, yes, I did this, yes, I did that. And then he had to listen to the victim impact statements. And 99% of them were people who were just like, I hope you rot in hell.
Yes.
99% of them. But there was one gentleman whose daughter was murdered. And he said, Mr. Ridgway, I forgive you. And, you know, I hope your soul finds peace and all that kind of stuff. And Ridgway had been stone-faced up to that point. And you could see that shook him.
Yeah.
That shook him, that somebody thought he, after what he had done, was still a human being of some resort. You know, it just, whoa.
Because Raider's a prime example. I mean, when you see him in court, that is some of the most terrifying footage I've ever seen of a convicted serial killer in court.
Yeah.
Because he's like a machine. They go right like that. And he just goes, yeah, I did this, mm-mm. And it's, you can see him, he's smiling as he's discussing it. It's almost like he's getting
it's
excited.
Back.
Oh, yeah, he's getting it. Well, we know, I mean, obviously, without going into too much detail, he did enjoy.
That was his thing.
Oh, yeah, he certainly enjoyed doing that. That's what gave him his thrills, shall we say, sickeningly for the rest of us. But he's one of those, when he was talking about it, sometimes, like you get Ramirez, who was just basically showing off and talking crap, you know, going, I'm Satan. You know, no, you're not, mate. You're just
just
badly addled drug addict who's lost his mind, really. And I'm not surprised. Once again, another childhood, you think, Jesus, there for the grace of God go I. But he seemed to just try and play up to this and try and create this supernatural persona where really he was just a shitty thief that strayed over into murder and sexual assault. Whereas BTK it gives me the shivers thinking about it. He really liked talking about it.
Have you read the Catherine Ramsland book, Confessions of a Serial Killer?
Yes.
She's brilliant. I've had discussions with her on a few occasions, and just how she talks about BTK being able to, he calls it cubing.
Yes.
How he puts everything into a cube, like a compartmentalizing, like his family life was in a cube. His work life was in a cube. His killings were in a cube, and never the twain shall meet kind of thing. He was just, so cold when he's talking about things and his dumb nicknames for things like project. He would just call a PJ because why not just write out the word project? I mean, it's not like people are not going to be able to decode what you're talking about anyway. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's always surprising as well. I mean, the other, I suppose, unheard of side of these particular kind of cases as well, Mike, is the perpetrators' families. Because there always seems to be this, most of the time it's unsaid, but social media is a very different animal, that most of the time these families have no idea what's going on. I mean, sometimes I've heard cases and I've just gone, I mean, other than him walking around waving a red flag over his head, how do you not realise something weird is going on? I remember watching once, where this guy was like, he went out for walks every night, 5 while midnight, with a gun and a balaclava. And he used to say, in case I got mugged or it got cold. And she didn't think anything of it. Oh, well, he liked to go for a walk every night. What, for 7 hours with a gun?
Right.
Really?
It's like Russell Williams in Canada here, the serial killer who around Tweed, who murdered some people. He had bags upon bags of ladies' underwear in their garage, and his wife had to have known about them. These, you know, hundreds of pairs of ladies' underwear in this garage. Like, what? Wouldn't you say, honey, it's a little, you know, I find it a little odd. You've got ladies' drawers in your in garbage bags in our garage. Can you explain that? I wonder if that conversation ever happened.
Yeah, I get into trouble if I bring a new book home, Mike.
Right.
Not another one, Paul. You know, if I came home with a Tesco bag full of pants, when I came round, I'd be wondering what had hit me first.
On the head. Yeah.
And then I'd ask the nurse for a drink, I think. But sometimes you're like, what is going on? But he was the same, this guy with the balaclava. I've forgotten his name now. But he'd got a special box in his wardrobe. And he said, under no circumstances can you go in this box. What? And people go, oh, okay, really?
Yep. Jerry Brudos was like that with his garage full of his crazy things, one of which was a woman's foot that he used to engage with.
Oh.
Yeah, and he was a really interesting character. But, you know, again, it was like, that's my private space. You don't come in my private space. And his wife just left him alone in there.
Absolutely. I mean, you occasionally find cases where they're in complete denial. I mean, Harold Shipman here, the last time his wife said anything, she said she didn't believe he'd done it, any of it.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that she was wearing stolen jewellery.
Who wants to believe that?
I think, especially with that particular case, because it's so many, Mike. I
mean, it was a lot.
At the minute, they reckon it's 227. Crazy. They reckon. But once again, as we've said about other characters, when did he start? Why did he start? And once again, it was only towards the end that technology caught him out, because he got caught falsifying medical records and not understanding that the metadata would always say when it had been changed. And he had no concept of that. He was just a user rather than a programmer. And so he got caught out. But once again, it was the morgue that flagged it twice. And it was only the second time they took notice of it, because they kept saying, this guy keeps sending us a lot of dead people.
Yeah. Well, so these stories make me think, what are there any smart ones out there who know how to subvert these different systems and that kind of thing? Are there people who are just able to get away with it? And that to me is even more scary, because it's always some dumb mistake, like some egotistical dumb mistake that gives these guys away. And sometimes I think maybe they want to get caught, like I think Ted Bundy killing Kimberly Leach as his last murder. It was just like he was in a frenzy at that point, and just he couldn't stop anymore. Like, his addiction was at its peak, and he had spiraled into whatever he'd spiral into. And So Kimberly Leach, he knew if he killed a little girl,
yeah,
he was going to go away. Mm. He was going to get caught. Maybe not consciously, but something in his subconscious had to know.
Yeah.
Because that was not a victim that people would not miss.
Mm. Absolutely. He was very good at, he just seemed to get away with it. I think he's a prime example of that. And if you look at his sentencing, which is one of the strangest things I've ever heard a judge say to a serial killer.
Yeah, yes.
He was basically saying, well, you know, if you hadn't murdered all these people, we'd probably go for a drink, essentially. He seemed to like him. And I'm thinking, hang on a minute, he's killed at least 35 women here.
You're a smart young man. Yeah. Like, what? This is the conversation we're going to have now?
I mean, you have to wonder what the victims thought and their families must have believed. And especially with Bundy, because I think there was definitely one, there might have been two survivors who testified against
him. Kathy Kleiner was one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I think Kathy Kleiner was in Chi Omega in the
She said she was in the sorority house, yeah.
Yeah, and he clunked her on the head, side of the head with the... You're thinking of, oh my goodness gracious, I can't remember her name right now, but it was in, I believe it was in Utah or Colorado.
Yes.
Where he tried to get a girl into his bug.
Yeah.
And she noticed that there was no seat. And, you know, maybe she shouldn't be getting into this car, and she fled.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
is that the one he pretended to be a police officer? Cop. And said, oh, we think you might have been shoplifting. Janet out of control. But he was, I mean, the double event proves he was so full of himself. I mean, who goes back to the same place you've just taken somebody and killed them to go and get somebody else?
I've driven that road there, and it's not far.
Mm.
I mean, so it would just be a few minutes drive, essentially. I mean, maybe in the summer it would be a little longer because of traffic around the area, because lots of people are being at the beach.
Mm.
But he would have taken one away, tied her up, done whatever he had done with her. Or maybe she was in the boot of his car. Who knows when he took the other one. Mm. But regardless, but that event at Lake Sammamish was crazy. And where he, you know, you see video of these remote, it looks remote where he dumped bodies, but it's actually not. It's pretty close to the highway.
Yeah.
So easy access for somebody who knows the area.
But, and also one of those that became one of those celebrations of his execution, which doesn't seem to happen very often these days. Mike, yeah. I'm not sure if they banned it, because it was, I mean, I can kind of understand why people want to celebrate someone of that nature's passing. I completely get that, whether they're involved in the case or not. It's ghoulish, it's mawkish, but it's human nature for some.
Right.
But it doesn't seem to be a thing these days, so I'm not sure if they eventually banned people doing it, because it seemed that most major serial killers of the 70s and 80s, there seemed to be like an after-show party going on outside wherever they were. And then I think it was either Bundy or Gacy. Somebody comes out afterwards and waves at them and just gives them the thumbs down.
Yeah
he's gone now.
Yep.
And everybody's like, woo!
Yeah, I have a feeling these things still go on. These displays still go on. I just don't think they're covered anymore because they are ghoulish, as you say, and it doesn't serve anybody.
Yeah.
Really. Yeah. It makes people look awful.
Yeah.
Even, you know. So what? Yes, you have to mete out justice however you mete it out. Mm. I'm not for the death penalty. I never have been.
Mm.
But I don't think covering that kind of story, like people saying that this person deserved to fry or whatever, is a good thing for the planet, really.
Yeah. True. Yeah. Do what you're going to do to him, but we don't need a live audience.
Yeah.
Vox pops about it, really.
Exactly.
No. No, not at all. I suppose it's one of those things that, especially when it comes to Canada, do you think it often gets overlooked? Because it's had some horrendous characters over the years. And I think unless you either are really into true crime or you know Canadians, Mike, most people, apart from Bruce MacArthur and probably Robert Pinkton, most people would struggle to name another Canadian serial killer. Do you think that's because...
Paul Bernardo would be...
Yes.
You know, Bernardo and Homolka would be worldwide, world known.
Mm-hmm.
But people like Michael McRae, nobody knows who he is. He's a serial killer who started his thing in Nova Scotia. And, you know, he killed a lot of women. David Snow, another guy who murdered people in Ontario and then fled to BC, where he was captured in a spectacular fashion. I've covered that on my show.
Mm-hmm.
They called him the cottage killer sometimes. But there are so many stories from here in Canada that are untold, and those are the ones that I tell on Dark Poutine. I've got scores and scores and scores more to tell, and I'm just passing episode 394, I think I wrote, just recently. So I've done a bunch, and there's no stopping. I mean, I don't always cover murder. I cover dark things as well.
Yes.
UFOs, Sasquatch, all those kind of things, because sometimes I need a break from true crime.
Yes.
As well.
Absolutely. Well, somebody once asked me several years ago, have you not thought about doing it, something to do with true crime? Because you obviously really like that particular subject as well. And I said, I don't think I'm better than the best Joes out there. And really, I've got enough on worrying about whether Bigfoot wants to eat me. Never mind.
Yeah.
Some nutter in a converted Volkswagen Beetle driving around.
Right.
Mike, I have to be honest.
I think you'd do a good job. I think you'd do a good job. I mean, there's a lot of cases that I'm unable to cover because my focus is mostly Canada. So maybe, you know, we should do like something together. I don't know. Might be game for that.
Yes. Well, I always need more things to keep me occupied. Might stop me worrying about such things.
Yeah, you've only got how many podcasts now that
two,
you do?
Two at the moment.
Yeah.
Two at the moment.
Yeah, I'm back down to one. I had to refocus on some things. I love Morgan. I love what she's doing.
Yeah.
And essentially, I got started in that podcast because she didn't have the confidence to do it herself initially. So I helped her get started, and it was at the point where I thought, you know, she's doing a great job. She doesn't need me.
Mm.
You know, she does a fantastic job. She doesn't need me.
Yeah.
And she's proven that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I've just done a spot on there.
There you
recently
go.
So it felt a bit strange not having you there, Mike, to laugh at my jokes.
Yeah. Well, I can laugh at your jokes anytime. You can call me up. I mean, I live alone. It's just me and these two dumb cats.
Hey, no problem. Well, don't encourage me like that, Mike. Especially now I know which time zone you're in. I'll know exactly when to hit you.
Yeah.
But as you touched there, you know, Dark Poutine and your interests are not just about true crime. Obviously, you've covered a lot of it, but you've also covered some of the stranger aspects of it. And once again, I think there are certain cases that unless you're into the Fortean, people won't know it, because Granger Taylor is a prime example of this. I'm one of those people that I sometimes think that everybody knows as much weird shit in their heads as I have.
Yeah.
And so when I say things to people and they've no idea what I'm talking about, I get a bit like, what? Whoa, hang on a minute. And Granger Taylor's one of those cases that I've known about it for decades.
Yeah.
And every so often it pops into the real world. There'll be a documentary about it. And then all the normal people I know, Mike, who basically asked me,
what the heck?
Yeah. And they'll say something. I'll go, oh, yeah, you know, yeah. Granger, oh, yeah. The spaceman.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, what do you know about it? And I said, well, I don't know anything, but I'm more than you guys. But do you think the fact about all this is that he was some people called him eccentric, but he seemed to be just one of those. I mean, as someone that's a late diagnosed with late development autism, Mike, when I've heard and read what he was, I just thought, well, the guy sounds like he's really into fixing things. I don't think that's a problem. He just had was really focused on a particular hobby.
I think had he lived, he would have also been diagnosed with autism for sure.
Mm.
For sure. He had all the earmarks of that particular thing. I'm neurospicy as well. I'm on the ADHD kind of spectrum, which is fun, especially when I have to get things done.
Yes.
oh, all the voices are telling me to go over here. Oh, look, shiny crows. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
What rabbit hole can I fall down now for an hour?
Yeah, and yeah. I'm there for many, many moons, and then nothing gets done. And why is there so many dishes in the sink?
Yeah. I mean, when I was talking about it with my partner, and she was like, why are you surprised? And I was like, well, I wouldn't say I was. And she said, you can't talk to you when you're watching something. It's like talking. Right. It's like you've frozen. You won't let anybody wash up. Only you wash up. Even if you've cooked, you wash up. You have to have
your thing.
Yeah, you have to have the plates stacked in a certain way. You always have your knives down. You know, you stir your coffee a specific way, and you do it so many times. And I was like, well, I just think I'm interested in things. I just didn't see it. And then the more she kept telling me, I was just like, oh, it's just that's been staring me in the face every day, Mike.
Of course. Of course.
But then again, probably won't be here doing
and
this.
And when you learn that stuff, you're going, oh, that's why that. Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, Granger was this interesting cat. He was from a place called Duncan, British Columbia. Duncan is the home of the world's largest hockey stick and puck, in case you didn't know.
I didn't.
Outside the hockey arena in Duncan, there is a gigantic hockey stick. I can't remember how big it is, but it's massive.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like it's built very well for a hockey stick. It just resembles a hockey stick.
It's just a bit of plywood.
But anyway, so Granger and his buddies found a train in the woods. Granger was always interested in building things and making things and putting things back together, fixing things, like you mentioned. But he found a rusting hulk of a train engine, a steam engine in the woods near his home. And he got it working again and got it to his place. They built tracks to get it to their place. Just ridiculous. This guy had a lot of ingenuity. Like, he was someone, I think, who should have gone into engineering for sure. Yeah. Just a smart cookie. But he was a bit of an oddball too, you know, like a little harder to talk to at times, and hung around with the younger kids. And probably because they didn't ask a lot of him, I've heard some people say horrible things about him that are unsubstantiated, but yeah, I mean, he started, you know, building his own UFO in his backyard. He used two satellite dishes together and then built sort of this room that was a UFO with the satellite dishes on the bottom and on the top, and kitted it out with, furniture and all of that kind of stuff, a little porthole for to look out. And he and his friends would sit in there and smoke dope and drop acid and do what young folks do, talk about aliens and all that kind of stuff. But Granger, he really started to get interested in aliens, to the point where he was talking to his friends about he was being called to go away with the aliens. And so on a stormy night, thunderstorm happening, it couldn't have happened at a more interesting time. On November 29th, 1980, this eccentric mechanic named Granger Taylor, he left a handwritten note for his parents tacked to his bedroom door saying he was going on a spacecraft for a 42-month journey. Mm. And, his passport was left behind. His dog, who'd gone with him everywhere, was left behind. He leaves his passport, his dog, everything behind. The last time he's seen is at like a little diner, says goodbye to people. And he disappears that night. And, in the crashing thunder of the evening, somebody who knew him, apparently, this lady who knew him had heard about his talks about going to see the aliens and heard the thunder crash and said, oh, there goes Granger. Like, whatever that means, there goes Granger. Like, he's gone to be with the aliens or whatever. And he disappeared. So 6 years later, they find bits of a truck that they're not quite sure was his, even though somebody says, oh, yeah, the VIN number was there. Mm. There, you hear really different stories about this. And his father said, yeah, from the house, dynamite had been missing. Cases of dynamite that he'd been using for one reason or another. And this guy had gone to visit the aliens, apparently, and perhaps had blown himself up to get to where he needed to go with the aliens. So there's folks who still believe that Granger is out there somewhere on his 42-month journey. And as we know, a 42 months in space is different than 42 months on the planet. So, you know, if you use Einstein's theory of relativity, maybe Granger is out there. Maybe he didn't really blow himself up because they haven't found any definitive remains of his. They did find some bone fragments, but they didn't connect them too definitively to Granger Taylor. So it's a weird story, strange story, but I it's one of those ones that I just love to sort of roll around in my head.
Yeah.
And what a great film that would make.
Yeah. I have to say as well, I've seen a couple of documentaries about it and they do seem to treat the story very respectfully, Mike. Because there are a lot of aspects of it that you could punch down quite easily.
Totally.
But the last one I saw, is it Rocket Man? I think that came out 2 or 3 years ago. I thought that was a really lovely film.
Yeah, Rocket Man was the one I interviewed the producer. I can't remember her name. I'm sorry. But I can't remember her name right now. But she was amazing and talking about Granger and for all his warts and, you know, what a lovely guy everybody said that he really was.
Yeah. The thing that strikes me about this is, like you say, he vanishes for 6 years and then they stumble across the remains of this truck. There have been arguments about the truck. People have said it's the wrong colour. He would never have driven that kind of truck. Others have said, oh, well, the engine block matches. It must be the same one. Fragments of bones. I find it hard to believe that if somebody's blown themselves up with dynamite, I don't care how bad a thunderstorm is, Mike, nobody heard that. Nobody heard it.
Well, it is kind of out of the way where he was. He was up on the mountain. I can't remember the name of the mountain currently, but he had driven, you know, through the woods up onto the mountain, and maybe they wouldn't have heard it for sure, or maybe you would have thought it was just the thunder that night.
Yeah,
I don't know, but yeah, it's far enough away that it, because I thought that exact same thing that you did. And so I did some more digging and found that, it's far enough away that it would have been a boom, but it could have been a boom that had to do with thunder as well. Mm.
True.
I like to think that he's still around. That, you know, he's going to show up this, he was a rather oafish, hirsute man, and he's going to show up. You know, wearing some weird spacesuit that looks like it's out of the 1970s or something from, Logan's Run or something like that.
I mean, I completely agree. I've got a little hole in my heart for him that I hope that he did go on on a space journey and he's gone wherever. Because, like you say, when you speak to the people that grew up with him and his friends and his family, they all said, yeah, he was a bit eccentric, but he'd got a heart of gold. He'd do anything, and he just liked to fix things. He was always doing stuff, and he was a bit scatty, but as we've said, clearly the guy was on the spectrum on some level. Because you can see him going from being really obsessed with engineering to where he discovers UFOs and aliens, and that just seems to completely overtake him from that point on. And it's quite quick as well.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? I mean, we've that was kind of what I learned doing Supernatural Circumstances is never say never and never say, you know, none of us really know what's happening. I mean, obviously there are grifters in that space as there are in every space. There are people who know for sure your uncle is trapped between the walls because he forgot to do blah, 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 blah when your aunt farted and like, honestly, the people who know what's going on are the people who scare me. Those are the people I tend to avoid. I'm not interested in somebody who claims they know all that stuff, that they're some kind of guru in that way.
Yes.
I'm more interested in, like, let's explore this and let's look at it and let's pick it apart. And but not make any really hard decisions about it, because we don't know. Mm. We don't know what happened to Granger that night. We really don't.
Yeah.
We don't know whether or not, you know, the aliens took him and blew up, you know, used the dynamite to blow it up to cover up the abduction or what.
Yeah.
You know, I sound like a crazy person, but I am.
And you're in the right space to allow yourself to feel that way, Mike.
There you go.
I think it's the inconclusivity of the wreckage as well. I think that hasn't helped, because you would suggest to them, well, why don't they go back? Because I'm not even sure if the bone fragments are still around, if they've been destroyed or thrown away. That happened. I mean, it's the 1980s. God knows what they used to do in certain places with evidence.
Right.
Which is always surprising when you stumble across certain cases.
They lost that evidence, by the way.
That's what they want us to think, Mike.
So, yeah, exactly.
If that doesn't say... You're just grasping at straws. I don't know what is. Oh, we've lost this concrete evidence that proves this this is who we think it is. But
the National Police Force for Canada, the RCMP, have lost it, or it's been destroyed because it was of no use to anybody anymore.
Yeah.
We've heard that from them over and over again. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Like the FBI agent who threw away the DB Cooper cigarette butts.
Right. Who needs those?
Yeah.
I mean, they're just cigarette. They're like, I mean, we know what kind of cigarettes he smoked.
I mean, the stories I've heard about that, when I spoke to Drew Breeson about it, who's a big D.B. Cooper investigator, and he was telling me that the tie, FBI agents would take it home with them and they would wear it to parties and things.
Oh.
And so when they came to test
that's nice.
And all this, and they go, oh, we've got DNA off it. He was like, it could be thousands of people, because that tie's been in and out of the FBI more times than most people have had hot dinners, Mike. And so many people had hold of it and taken it on holiday, shown it to the friends, brought it home, gone, oh, look at this, DB Cooper's tie. And so it's pointless. It's useless. There's so much degradation and stuff on it that, once again, that's another strange mystery. But I think the fact with Granger is that the evidence has been lost, but they've told us that's what it is. And they're the kinds of explanations that make people think, do they really think we're that daft?
Yeah, they do. They do.
Because you've got a strange thing with certain things in Canada when it comes to UFOs, because two of my particular favourite cases are both from Canada, which is Shag Harbour and Falcon Lake.
Absolutely. I grew up just down the road from Shag Harbour.
I mean, what was it like there? Because obviously Shag Harbour is, what, 67?
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's an incredible case. It's one of them where you've got all these witnesses who seem to have no reason to make this incredible story up. And then you've got the official explanation. And it's one of those where you think, right, why are this random group of Canadians just making something up that bears
that's
no resemblance?
That's not something that would happen there, just so you know. In Nova Scotia, where I'm from, you know, sure, there's conspiracy theorists. We see it now with Jack and Lily Sullivan, who are these two kids who've gone missing in Nova Scotia. It's all over the place.
Mm.
And everybody's chiming in with a theory, but something did happen to them. And that's the thing. Like, people in that province won't talk about something unless they really do believe that something happened. There is evidence that something happened that night.
Yeah.
Well, the eyewitness evidence, seeing the foam in the water, all of that kind of stuff. This is an enduring mystery. And it's interesting now that we see a lot of people who are interested in disclosure, the Tennessee senator, I believe his name escapes me, but he was talking about how he believes that UFOs aren't from out around because of what he's been being told now in his disclosure hearings, that they are from within and the deepest parts of the ocean. So to have a UFO, quote unquote, that went missing off the coast of the Atlantic is no big stretch.
Mm.
It really isn't.
Mm.
You know, like maybe there's a base there. I don't know. There is actually a secret base in that area in Shelburne. All the kids knew about it. It's a submarine base where they did listening. Like,
yeah,
we just knew about it, but no, it wasn't. It's not an official base on any maps, but everybody knows it's there.
Yes. Yeah, we have those kinds of bases here as well, Mike.
Sure.
It's like a massive building, and everybody's, oh, yeah, that's the secret base, is it?
Nobody and Falcon knows. Lake is a fantastic story. Stan yes. Mikuluk and his weird burns on his yes. chest that look like a grill of some description. Or,
yeah.
What a strange story that is. And, I mean, the Canadian Mint has memorialized that in a coin, yeah. which is kind of fantastic.
Yes.
I love it that we're so open to having conversations about that kind of thing here. I mean, I know a lot of people who poo-poo everything about this stuff. My co-host, Matthew, for Dark Poutine, he hates me talking about this stuff. He's like, you sound crazy. You sound like a crazy person. I'm just, you know, being open-minded, which you should try sometime, you know? But yeah, there's plenty here. Like Chris Rutkowski, he's fantastic. I don't know if you've spoken to him, but yes. he is a fantastic resource for Canadian UFOs. I mean, he's the guy that the government sends all the reports to, and he collates them for them.
Yes.
And we've recently just learned that they are talking about a Canadian pot, the possibility of a department in the Canadian government that will look at UFOs, UAPs, or whatever the flavor of the week is, what we're calling them today.
Yeah.
But that we'll start to look at them a little more seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had the strange things that had to be shot down over, you know, northern Canada.
Those
just
weather
recently.
Balloons.
Yeah, or whatever they were. Were they weather balloons or was it swamp gas?
As soon as they said weather balloon, I thought, oh, no. Here we
yeah,
go
here
again,
we go
guys.
Again.
Oh,
yeah.
It's not the 1990s all over again. I'm not having this.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But I mean, the Falcon Lake, I've seen so many. Oh, he was drunk and fell on a barbecue. I didn't even know disposable barbecues were a thing in 19. Because that's the other thing. That also happened in 1967. It's just the opposite yeah. side of the country from,
that's right.
from Shag Harbour. So Canada was it was happening. Sometimes you find that you've got two monumental cases that seem to happen in the same place. Near enough
yeah.
at the same time. And that's a prime example of it, that when you realize they both happened on opposite sides of the country in the same year, that's a bit weird for me.
There's been some big stories related to Canada as far as UFOs go. I mean, Betty and Barney Hill were returning from Montreal when they
yes.
were abducted.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I have yet to cover that on the show. It's kind of on my list of to-dos.
Yeah.
But I find that case really fascinating too, you know?
Yes.
My mom and dad's friend, he used to own a clothing store in my hometown, and he told us a story one time of around 1967, strangely enough, driving down the Lehave River, and a large red football-shaped craft was pacing him along the highway as he was driving. And he was so terrified, like he pulled over and it just sped off in another direction.
Hmm.
Like, I don't know, maybe he'd been smoking a little too much of the ganja at the time or something, but you shouldn't be driving when you're doing that, fella.
I say, you probably not be able to see the road, never mind anything else.
No.
If you were that far gone. But I mean, one of the other ones that seems to get overlooked, and I'm not sure because it's a bit murky, but it's also connected to unsolved mysteries, is the Guardian case.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that one, I don't think. Maybe if you get into it, I will be.
So the Guardian case occurred at the end of the 80s and involved a lady who claimed that she was being visited by extraterrestrials and filmed it. And it ended up that a videotape was sent anonymously to Unsolved Mysteries of the craft coming down. And people just kind of put it off as a hoax. They weren't really doing
sure.
it. She passed away. And then I think her nephew was clearing the house out and he found all these notes about the case and what they'd been saying to her and everything.
Wow.
And that, I think, is from about late 80s, early 90s.
Where did this take place?
So the Guardian UFO case occurred in West Carlton, Ontario in 1991. Diane Labanek put her children to bed whilst her husband was out running an errand. And at around 10 p.m., she heard her dogs barking and went to look at the back window to investigate. And there she saw some red flames and smoke, which seemed to be emanating from a nearby field. She didn't believe it was a fire because it didn't seem to be moving. Instead, it was fixed in one spot. And as she was watching, she then saw an unidentified flying object come down from the sky and land next to the flames. And on top of the object was a blue flashing light. She continued to watch it, and as she was watching it, the flames began to disappear. And then all of a sudden, a helicopter arrived and the craft levitated slightly and flew along the ground under the helicopter so it couldn't see it.
Hmm.
And so she began to start watching out for it more often than not. Now, apparently, this was her second experience because a couple of years later, there'd been a mass UFO sighting over a nearby swamp. Not suggesting that it's swamp gas,
swamp
Mike.
Gas. Yeah.
But that happened also in West Carlton in 89. But yet, about a year later, a videotape from Canada arrived to Edgewater, Maryland, which was the office of Bob Oshler, who was a well-known UFO researcher and former NASA specialist. It had no address. And inside the package were documents, pictures, a map, and the videotape, all pertaining to this 1991 signing. And the tape was labelled Guardian and had a fingerprint on it. And so basically the video showed what seemed to be the incident that Diane had seen, but from the opposite side. So it was two people had seen it. And that's what ended up being shown on Unsolved Mysteries. But it was like a massive case in the early 90s. And then it just kind of drifted on.
Well, in the early 90s, where like at that time, I was very high and drunk. So so I was at the end of my addiction. So I
yes.
have a good excuse why I don't remember it.
Yes,
but
you do.
That is a fascinating case. I am really, really curious about that. And I just may or may not have added it to my list of episodes for Dark Poutine because I am looking for another UFO case. And this one is cool.
Yes.
Thanks for bringing that up. I love that.
I think it's one of Canada's forgotten UFO cases because a lot of people have just dismissed it as a hoax.
Not only has it been forgotten by me, I didn't know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that shows you how far gone I've been sometimes, Mike. Yeah.
You've been down that rabbit hole, digging.
I've watched that episode and that footage far too many times. It is strange, I'll say that. So I'll leave it with you. It's in your wheelhouse on your side. So
sure, that's great. Yeah.
See what you can dig out. But it's a fascinating case, primarily because we've got this video, this mysterious package. And she was quite open about talking about it. People asked her. She said, oh, yeah, and told them everything she saw.
Mm-hmm. And was she diagnosed with anything?
I don't believe
ever?
So.
Yeah,
I don't believe so. I think she passed away about 10 years ago.
Mm. Wow. Well, I need to learn more. I'm going to be distracted. I need to learn more about this.
Yes. You will know Diane Labanek more than you know yourself by the end of that, probably.
Okay.
Well, I'm glad I could share something with you there.
Yeah, for sure. That was really interesting. I'm so happy that we could connect and do this thing.
Mm.
It's been a long time coming.
It is. I mean, obviously, as I said, and before I let you go, obviously, I have to talk about your wonderful books. Is it sometimes one of those aspects, Mike, when you look at where you are in your life now and as some of the insights that you've given into your life and the challenges you've faced and overcome, and fair play to you, sir. Is it sometimes you have to pinch yourself a little bit? I mean, I'm nowhere near the level of success that you've achieved so far in your career, but I get deeply, not uncomfortable, but I still don't get used to anybody knowing who I am. If I'm at an event or something and somebody says, excuse me, are you Paul Bestall? And I can feel my stomach shrink a little bit. And it's nice. Yeah. Nobody's come up to me and gone, all right, ain't your show. You're all right, knobhead. Or anything like that. Yeah. I find it deeply humbling, Mike, that someone, I mean, I know lots of people listen to me waffle on with a variety of people from
me
around
too.
The world.
Yeah.
But I'm still not used to it. And I would imagine for yourself, like we said, author, podcaster, you've been on The Traitors. It must be difficult sometimes to comprehend it. It's like you've won Christmas over and over again, I would imagine sometimes.
It feels like that. It feels like I'm very grateful for the life I have. And actually, to be honest, I still have a lot of anonymity. People don't know who the hell I am. I've not been stopped on the street. I've had people message in Facebook groups and saying, oh, I think I saw Mike Brown on the street and it was actually me, you know. And it's like, yeah, you should have said something. Pull over, say hello. I would love that. That would do wonders for my ego. But but nobody has done that to me yet. I mean, I've had a few small instances of it where I was at a West Edmonton Mall. Morgan and I were doing a thing, and I'm at West Edmonton Mall buying some Christmas presents, and one of the people behind the counter looked at my hat and it said Dark Poutine. She said, oh, I love that show. And I said, you do? And she said, yeah. And I said, thank you. And she looked, she's like, oh my God. Like, she recognized the hat before she recognized me, which I'm good with, you know. It keeps me in my place.
Yes.
You know, like, I've had two best-selling books, Murder, Madness, and Mayhem, which in trade paperback did well. It was a bestseller. Now it's in mass market paperback and is a bestseller again for even longer, which is mind-blowing. And recently I've also released Strange, Spooky, and Supernatural, my second book. That was a bestseller. Like, how does... I was the crappiest English student. I was terrible. And I didn't get things done. You know, we now know it's because I have my neuro spiciness and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I need certain situations to facilitate my work. But I would have never believed that a little kid from Bridgewater, Nova Scotia would be able to do the things that I've gotten to do.
Yeah.
I am just humbled and blown away that I get to do all the things I have.
Yeah. You don't have I met a listener recently who knew my route to my day job. He said, I've seen you walking to work.
No, oh, yeah.
Do you walk on such and such? And I was like, yeah. Yes, I do.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Oh,
okay.
Oh, no.
I mean, they were lovely and fine, and we were laughing about it.
Sure.
But I am worried. And then I was at another event and somebody else came up and said, hello, I've come to listen to you talk and whatever.
Right. But if they're there to specifically hear you speak, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
That's because you've advertised that you're going to be there.
I'd be more upset if I started talking to a room of chairs, Mike.
Right. I was afraid that was going to happen. We did. So as part of the Vancouver Podcast Festival in 2019, I believe, we did a live show for episode 100.
Wow.
And we did it at the Rio Theater. It's this old movie theater with like a balcony and all that kind. It's a really great place to see all kinds of great things. And I thought, oh no, nobody's going to come. I really believed that nobody was going to come. I put all this effort into... doing a playlist for the pre thing. And then I did a really great PowerPoint presentation that we used during the episode to give visuals to people who just didn't have to hear me and my co-host speak. But it was when I walked out on stage at first and saw the whole place was packed. It was packed. And everybody is standing there, like standing up and cheering us on. I don't think I've ever had such an amazing feeling in my entire life. Like, you know, like Sally Field, they like me.
Yeah.
They really like me. And and as somebody who has self-esteem issues still to this day, I feel like I am an imposter doing things that I shouldn't be doing. Every bit of like, every time somebody pumps my tires just a little bit, it's really nice.
Yeah. I think that's the thing about being neurospicy, Mike. We've all got low self-esteem, really.
Yeah.
And we all feel like we're blagging it, and somebody's going to find out that we don't know what we're doing, really. We're just like ducks. We look brilliant on the surface, but underneath we're like madly paddling.
Yeah, paddling so fast, yeah. Yep.
But I mean, it's edifying because it shows that if you've got a passion and a love for something, sometimes we all take the diverted route to get to where it is, and we don't go through the normal channels of life to get as some do. And I think that gives us a bit more satisfaction that we were always meant to do this. We've just had to take a certain detour to get to where we are.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to be in radio when I was a kid. And my dad knew the general manager of CKPW, the radio station in my hometown, and introduced me to him. And this guy talked me out of doing radio, essentially talked me like, you got to start sweeping the floors and you got like, and I thought, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
But always in the back of my mind, I had this thing, like I wanted to do radio. I got into podcasting because I eventually wanted to do radio. Well, here's the thing. I'm announcing it here. On October 17th, 2025, there's a new show in major networks in Canada on the Chorus Network, Toronto, Edmonton, Calgary, Winnipeg, Vancouver, forget my hometown, where I'm going to be doing a two-hour time block of introducing true crime podcasts for people to listen to. It's the first true crime radio show in Canada.
Wow. Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, Chorus, the guy who does the content development for Chorus, Dunner, his name is, he's a member of a band, a country band called Washboard Union. They're great. They're just about to tour in Australia, but he called me up and said, I got something I want to ask you. I'm always being neurospicy. I think, oh no, he's going to fire me. We're done. Dark Poutine is shuttering its doors.
Yeah.
But he said, no, we're thinking about a true crime podcast show on Chorus Networks. Would you like to do it? And I didn't hesitate. I said, absolutely. You know, I don't need time to think about that. That's what I've always wanted to do.
Oh.
And we are also talking about that maybe leading to another true crime show that is a little more live and radio-based. So
fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, good for you. Congratulations, man.
Like you said, I feel like I'm winning Christmas all the friggin' time. And like, honestly, I don't feel like I deserve it. I honestly do not.
Yeah.
I honestly don't feel I do. And I'm sure there are some people who think, well, that guy doesn't deserve this.
Yes. There'll always be some. There will be.
Yeah.
There will be. But
but there's a lot of people who love me who are cheering for me too. So I'm good. I'll hang with those folks.
Absolutely. And all power to you for doing so. I think that's the thing. I mean, also the problem with neurospicy is we'll focus on the one bad thing and not the 100 great things.
Yeah, always. It's like reading reviews. I cannot do it because there's that one star. There's 50 five-star reviews and one-star review. And that one gets stuck in my craw. Yeah. I want to talk to that person.
Yeah. My professional standpoint on this is I don't give a shit. I don't read them.
You.
I don't care.
I don't anymore.
I get enough nice emails and comments from people to make me realize that
totally.
that's what, which for me is quite unusual because usually I would do that. But for some reason in this field, I don't care.
Yeah.
So it is one of those things. But so you've got Poutine continuing. You've got this wonderful new opportunity with a true crime show. Like I say, you're riding the waves continually from the brilliant two books, which I have both, and they are fabulous.
Thank you.
For anybody who likes weird things and true crime, perfect for a person such as myself. I mean, what else can you possibly try and fit in going forwards, Mike?
Well, I like rock and roll, so maybe I should learn to play an instrument or sing. I don't know. That's another thing that's always kind of like, oh, I would love to, but no. Mm. But yeah, I'm bad at anything musical, so maybe I'll just be the DJ. I don't know.
Well, yeah, that's good enough. I'm doing my regular annual DJ spot in a couple of weeks at one of my local venues. They always...
Oh, there you go.
Whenever they do an 80s special, Mike, I'm the man to bring the...
they wheel you out.
They bring the camp 80s pop bangers. I'm your man.
Good for you. The next time I come to the UK, we are going to connect.
Absolutely.
We definitely have. I want to take you to the pub.
Yes.
I'll drink a coffee and I'll feed you beer all night long.
My kind of date, that, Mike.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, if I ever get it home, because I've got family in Canada, you see. So
oh.
I've been meaning to come over for, they've been there since 1991. So I am.
Whereabouts are they?
Just down from Barrie.
Okay. Yep.
My cousin Rob's done a lot of work out in sort of New England and that kind of area. So obviously being there They wanted to, they got the green card over because my cousin was a nurse. And so they came over at the beginning of the 90s. So they've been there almost half their lives now, and I've yet to visit. It's one of those things.
So if you make it that far, it'll be easier for me to get to Ontario.
Absolutely.
I don't have to cross a border.
Yeah. So yes, we'll certainly do that on either side of the Atlantic whenever it happens, my friend. That'd be lovely. So do you have any other plans for another book? Because I mean, like I say, your first
I'm working on book number three as we speak, yeah.
Ah, so are you returning to the true crime field, or are you continuing to cast your net over all kinds of weirdness?
Yeah, we're going back to true crime for this one. I've got some... I do some other stuff. I study consciousness, as you probably understood, through supernatural circumstances. Mm-hmm. So this one that I'm currently working on is going to be another 20-odd stories of true crime from around the world, mostly in Canada. And there's another one that I'm rolling around. I do a lot of lucid dreaming. I'm trying to get into that. So it fits and starts, but... At some point, I think I might want to write a book about my journey in that. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting. I've had some dreaming. I mean, we spend 8 hours a day of our lives, hopefully, asleep with our eyes closed.
I wish.
So what is there? There's all kinds of stuff going on in our brains at the time. It's not just our brains turn off. There's stuff going on. So... A lot of people believe that we can actually, you know, do a lot of creative work and that kind of thing in our sleep. And I have. I've made decisions. I've been able to have really interesting things happen. I've had premonitory dreams. All these things I will talk about in an upcoming book.
That's fascinating. I mean, it's like a running joke on the ghost story, guys, because I was a terrible dreamer, Mike, until I stopped smoking cigarettes. And within a week of that, I had the weirdest dream I've ever had in my entire life, which stuck with me. And it became that I ended up discovering a Bigfoot body with my friend Farazuka Balk, the famous actress,
notable for Vancouver.
Yeah, yeah, strangely, she was in my dream. And she was my Bigfoot
partner.
She
could be in my dream too, if you want.
And we ended up going to dinner at Fred Savage's house.
Oh,
for
Fred
some reason.
Savage from The Wonder Years.
And these are people that I have no cultural adulation towards, Mike. I'm aware of who all they are. And I just didn't... And I woke up the following morning, I was like, what the hell is going on here? Is this some kind of like nicotine detox? Then, ever since then, I've just had sporadically weird dreams, but I probably would say the previous 20 years, I could count the dreams I could remember on one hand, ever. And now I have all kinds of weird dreams. Last week, I had a dream about... going on the lash in New York in the 1970s with David Byrne from Talking Heads and David Bowie. David Byrne kept getting us into cheeky scrapes because he was right mischievous. And it was like a really nice dream. And I thought, where's that come from?
Do you write them down? Do you journal them?
I do when they're odd. I just go, Byrne and Bowie. What is what I wrote? Yeah.
Sure, if that's what you can remember. The more I journal, the more detailed they get. I had a dream about Billy Corgan the other night from Smashing Pumpkins. He called me over, of course, because that's what he would do. And we were having a conversation while he was picking a scab off his big toe. And I noticed that Billy Corgan had really tiny feet. So, yeah, that was that dream. Yeah.
Oh, did he mention his New Order collection? Which is one of the strange things I learnt about Billy Corgan. He worships the ground New Order walk on.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah. He's a massive New Order fan.
They are great.
Yeah, well, they're one of my particular favourites, I have to say.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm of that ilk too. I mean, I'm 56, so...
Yes. So we all get a bit giddy when we hear the beginning of Blue Monday.
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely.
Well, Mike, it's been absolutely lovely to have a proper conversation with you on my show for a change. Where can everybody find your shows, your books, follow you online and keep up to date with the numerous plates that you continue to spin for us all to enjoy?
I mean, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram. I don't use X that much because of, well, you know, anyway. Mm. But at Mike Brown, I'm on Instagram and I have mikebrown.com, Mike Brown with an E on the end, MikeBrowne. And I have darkpoutine.com, and you can follow Dark Poutine and on Spotify or wherever you stream audio.
Brilliant. I shall put links to everything in the show notes for everybody. And I want to say once again, thank you so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure. I always enjoy spending time in your company. You always make me chuckle. And I look forward to the next time we have a conversation, my friend. You take care.
Awesome. Thanks.